Good morning, everybody. It's Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio, and I am your host, Jim Wilkins. The show was conceived by Laura Smith and our producer, Kathleen Morgane, has fortuitously arranged to have a visitor with us today. Anna King, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna is a longtime expert on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and its impact on particularly the peoples of the Hanford Reach, but generally the overall environmental impact of Hanford. And Anna, thanks for being with us today at Coast Community Radio.
I sure appreciate it. I'm a correspondent with the Northwest News Network, which is also servicing Coast Community Radio. So for all the years I've reported, I've been to Astoria a few times, but I haven't been to your station. And it's such a pleasure to be here. You have such a beautiful view.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure for us to have you. I'd like to start out with kind of a little biographical sketch of Anna and where'd you grow up and where'd you go to school and all of that. And also, how did you get started doing what you're doing?
Yeah, so I grew up on a small cattle farm, like a little ranch, outside of Roy, Washington, which if you know where Olympia is and you know where Tacoma is, if you drew kind of a little line in between, that's kind of where Roy is. And I grew up on the far side of the Fort Lewis Reservation, so pretty remote. It was about 45 minutes to the nearest bread and milk, and that was just bread and milk. If you wanted something else, you had to go further into town. But now it's gotten quite a bit more urban. There's not as many farms. A lot of the dairy cattlemen children that I grew up with are actually in eastern Washington, where I reside now. I went to college over at WSU in Pullman and graduated with honors out of the Murrow College of Communications there. I started in broadcast, but they told me with my travel to Italy and my study there, I couldn't get out in time with my sequence courses. So I switched back over to writing and became a newspaper woman when I first started in my career. And then now I'm back in broadcast here. So it was kind of a fun time to do all that. But I just really enjoy radio. It's been so fun telling stories with actual voices in my stories. You know, if somebody has a gravelly voice, I can show that on the radio. It's just such a lovely medium.
But I'm curious, how did you, we'll get into your particular expertise regarding the Hanford Reservation and the Hanford Reach, but how did you end up doing that? Just as a journalist, you were interested in it, and all of a sudden it became almost an obsession, it sounds like.
Well, when I first got out of my career, when I came back from Italy and I started my career, I started in little tiny newspapers. So I started at the Nisqually Valley Herald. I graduated to the Puyallup Valley Herald, graduated again as a freelancer for the Tacoma News Tribune. And then all of a sudden we had this big thing called 9/11 happened, and it just really rocked the freelance world. All of my gigs went away because they were sending all the money into war correspondents going over to start the wars. And so what happened is I kind of quickly found myself without a writing gig, and I needed to support myself. So I took a statewide road trip tour to find a job, and my last stop was Tri-Cities, Washington. Walked into the Herald, shook the hand of Rick Larson, who was one of the top editors at the time there. And I said, hey, you got to hire me. I know farms. I know water. I know fish. Give me a job. And he said, all right. And so I packed up my little car. I had this little Mazda car, and my mom and dad were like shoving Costco toilet paper in the back of the car there, trying to get me set up to go over there. And I got a little apartment, you know, in Kennewick, and I just started writing there. And I became, you know, the top ag writer for the Tri-City Herald. And I covered the Hanford Reach National Monument, natural resource issues, salmon issues. And I had a pretty wide travel berth. I could go all the way down to Portland. I could go all the way up to Spokane. I could go all the way down to Hood River. And I was able to cover a really large swath of the region. And then, you know, newspapers just kind of had this hard time happen. And and so, you know, about 8, 10 years ago, I kind of realized that this new industry was going to have some hard times. And at the same time, a gal named Kathy Duchamp from Seattle, Washington, who was really big at KUOW radio there, came and found me and offered up this job in radio. And I thought, that sounds really fun and something I could dig into. And she said, you know, we'll give you a car, we'll give you some travel budget, and you can roam around and tell stories from the back roads. And for a farm girl out of Roy, Washington, that sounded like a pretty good gig.
Yeah. Well, you know, during the start of the Second World War, there was a federal project called the Manhattan Project. And the Manhattan Project found themselves needing plutonium. And so the federal government, using the right of eminent domain, went to the Hanford area and basically took it over. But people lived there. There were communities there. And Hanford came in, the federal government, and started making plutonium. And I'm curious, what's your take on how that impacted the communities that existed there prior to the federal government's exercising their right of eminent domain?
Yeah, you know, it was devastating to both the white settlement communities, the farming communities called White Bluffs and Hanford along the Columbia River, along the what we call the Hanford Reach, which is the last free-flowing stretch of the Columbia River. And that kind of runs between Vernita Bridge and then down to like the Richland area is kind of considered the Hanford Reach. And that was devastating, but it was also incredibly devastating to our Native American communities, the Wanapum Band, the Yakima, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation, the Nez Perce. All of these communities used this Hanford area as either a pass by, a stop through, a fishing site for their ancient ceremonies, just medicine foods. There's plants on Rattlesnake Mountain without names because they're the only place that they exist is right there in that spot. It's the only kind of type of high desert arid climate that is in that spot. And so they're plants that don't exist anywhere else, but right there on the Hanford Monument. And in 2000, President Clinton protected that land that kind of borders the interior of the Hanford site that's contaminated. And it's some of the most pristine country that we have left because it wasn't touched. It was protected by the federal government. So there was no agriculture. There was no roads built. The development was retarded in that area, thankfully, because it's so very beautiful right now. And we're in springtime and all the wildflowers are out right now out there.
Well, you're kind of heading where I wanted to go, which is that prior to the federal government's involvement in Hanford, we've described it as a beautiful place with some wonderful communities. The impact of the federal government coming in and developing that must have had an extraordinary economic impact. And people moved there to build Hanford. And I wonder if you could characterize the change, the evolution that happened during the actual construction of Hanford.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just was overnight, basically.
Right.
I mean, they in 1942, they sighted, they flew over Hanford and then they visited, and scoped out the landscape and said, we've got cold, deep water here from the Columbia. It's relatively unpopulated. It's remote. There won't be a lot of populations that are right near here. And remote is relative. I mean, to the Wanapum Band, this was their home, not remote. But
exactly.
It was just this kind of confluence of perfect scenarios for the federal government to have a super secret mission called the Manhattan Project. And so within a month, they gave farmers and ranchers just days and weeks to get off their ranch that they had put so much toil into, and for Native Americans to, where their grandmothers were born, where their great grandmothers were born, to leave those lands. It was incredible. And it just started to, they put the boundaries up and they started protecting it, and then they just started to work, and then hundreds and thousands of workers came to Hanford and overnight built reactors. They built the B reactor in like almost a year.
Right.
It was amazing. And that's the first full-scale nuclear reactor in the whole nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just there 2 weeks ago touring around in that reactor and recording. I've been there several times, but every time I walk through the doors and I hear that echoey cacophony of sound and look at the reactor face with all the dials and the rods and the pigtail electronics and tubing, I mean, it's just incredible that they were able to have this sophisticated of engineering back towards World War II, and that it was so urgent. It was so, you know, that the country was so worried that they couldn't win the war and that we weren't winning the war. And to build a machine that could help us, it was pretty incredible history. Now, that's left us with this incredible legacy of radioactive and chemical waste. We have 56 million gallons of radioactive sludge sitting in aging underground tanks that are World War II and Cold War era tanks. And we have to clean this up. But the story and the history and the layers there are just really deep. It's so fun to tell stories there.
Yeah, and they've left us with about 177 underground tanks filled with who knows what. In many cases, nobody knows what.
It's a witch's brew of caustic chemicals. There are so many chemicals involved in there. Stuff that Aaron Brockovich went after in California.
Yeah.
They're still trying to figure out exactly what's in each of those tanks. And they are doing so much good work and so much good science. In fact, my husband, Andy, is a scientist that works regularly with radionuclides. And it's so complex. He works with the microbiology of these that change the chemistry of radionuclides traveling under in the groundwater. But I mean, the level of detail that is and the science and the engineering going on at Hanford. I often tell the story for people who haven't been there and seen it. But when I go to the gym at 5 a.m. in the morning, I pass through a freeway that is called the Bypass Freeway. And it's lanes upon lanes of traffic all headed into the Hanford site. And it's wall-to-wall traffic. It's like being on I-5 headed towards Seattle from Tacoma at 7 in the morning. That's how many workers go out to Hanford and try and clean this up for us every day.
Right. And of those 177 tanks, kind of an unknown number, maybe Andy would know, but many of them, or at least some of them, are leaking. And they're leaking this unknown stuff into the groundwater, which I assume is percolating over into the river.
Yeah, so it's not reached the river yet. There are some constituents from closer to the river that have reached the river, and they're called underground water plumes.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, they're actually kind of leaking at a rate that is pretty surprising. There's more than 1 million gallons of radioactive sludge that has leaked to the environment from different tanks already. And some of these stories are going to be tackled in my new series called Daughters of Hanford, which is coming out.
I was just getting ready to go there.
Okay.
Well, let's go ahead and... first, I think we're a little bit early, but I'll do our mid-break blurb here. This is Coast Community Radio. It's Friday with Jim, and we'll be here until 10 o'clock. And I'm delighted to be speaking with Anna King, talking about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and kind of its impact on basically all of us. But you mentioned briefly the Daughters of Hanford. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I believe there's 12 radio stories that you've produced that will be airing. In fact, one aired this morning.
Yeah, and so I was so pleased to learn that Coast Radio, Coast Community Radio, aired my latest story, which I just uploaded late last night, called Natalie Swan. It's just about this young woman who is a Yakima Nation member of the Yakima Nations. And she is so shy, just incredibly shy. But she's found herself in this position of having to speak up for her entire entire nation and for the Yakimas to say what's important. And that is the plants, the animals, the landscape, the cultural resources on the Hanford landscape. You know, they don't see it as a ruined place. They don't see it as a desolate, ugly place. They see it as home. They see it as sacred. The mountaintops are used for ceremonies. They find medicine and food plants in areas similar to Hanford. They see so much value. It's one of their most historic fishing sites along the Columbia on the Hanford Reach. And so for them to walk away from Hanford and to leave it damaged and say, we're not going to clean this up, is just not an option. And she had this one quote in the story that I brought this morning that just said, the Yakima Nation is fearless in protecting what's important to it, these natural resources. And they will use lawyers, they will use any means possible to make sure that it's cleaned up and that it is accounted for. And it was just such a powerful story. She's so shy. We sat on the Yakima River and we sat there for, you know, several hours, and her lips were quivering, and she was just so incredibly nervous to be, you know, recorded. And so we held hands on the banks of the Yakima River to tell that story together. And it took many hours for her to kind of come to peace with talking on the radio. But I was so fortunate that she granted me the interview, because she's so wise, just at a young age. She's a young mother, but it was just incredible to speak with her. And she's a part of this council that pretty much has all these federal agencies and state agencies and the tribes of the region all together. And she helps them come to decisions about how they're going to protect the plants and the animals and the landscape. And it doesn't always go the way that they want it to, or it always isn't in a collaborative fashion. And so they have to come to agreements over really tough stuff. And she's a voice on that council. And so it's an incredible job.
Do you feel that she has a pretty firm grip on the hazards that are presented in Hanford? I mean, some of these hazards are really complicated, chemically, biologically. It's difficult to assess the real damage that can occur from these hazards. Do you think that she and her people have a real handle on that kind of thing?
I think the Yakima Nation is one of the most astute students of what needs to happen at Hanford. They care about it so much, and nothing makes you care more than having something happen in your own backyard or your what you consider your home. And it's so deep for them that there is no separation between the land and their people. They're so together, mm-hmm. that there's no separation there. So they care. They call it, like, right now the season is the root season that we're in. Springtime is when the root foods come to the people, and they call them their sister foods. And what that means is that these women roots grow from the ground and come back, and their mothers and their sisters and their grandmothers are coming back to feed the people. And they celebrate this in a root feast every year. And so for them to say, those roots over there at Hanford, we're just not going to touch those anymore, that's like saying, we're not going to remember my grandma anymore. It's so close to them and their culture that they can't forget. They can't go somewhere else. They have to be there. And
yeah,
so
they
have
go,
to clean it up.
They can't go eat those roots, can they?
Well, there is hope that in many, many generations that some areas of Hanford would be clean enough where they could go back and at least have some religious ceremonies or to visit the land, hmm. or perhaps collect medicine or collect food there. What's a misconception about Hanford, when you hear about Hanford, you just think scary, bad Simpsons show, nuclear, you know. But really, it's a juxtaposition between some of the most pristine land on Earth and the most contaminated land on Earth. There, in the central part of the site, there's all this tank waste, radioactive waste that was just dumped into soil pits in mm-hmm. the ground. But like on the fringes of Hanford, that was all just protective border to the Hanford Central site. So they didn't really do a lot on Rattlesnake Mountain or in a part of the reach called the AIL, the Arid Lands Ecology Unit. There's all of these beautiful swaths of bunch grass and beauty that they don't even touch. And so it's been protected from farming, from road building, from all of these things that we've done to the rest of our land, from grazing. It's been left still. And so it's just like walking back into time. It's like walking in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark to visit this land. In fact, Lewis and Clark, I know, spent quite a bit of time here in your area, but they spent some time upriver with us too, mm-hmm. at the confluence of the Snake and the Columbia Rivers. And so it's like walking back in time. It's amazing to walk out onto the Hanford Monument. And some people think the desert is ugly, but I would say maybe you just haven't looked close enough. It's like an old growth forest. The sagebrush can be up to 100 years old or older. There's lichen communities. There's stuff called cryptogamic crust that grows under sagebrush. It's like a little community of algae and mosses, and it covers the desert soil and keeps the dust down so we don't have dust storms. It's an amazing community of plants. And if you look at the crust with a microscope, it looks like one of your big forests here, just in miniature. Hmm. It's an amazing ecology. And we have all these little iconic animals like the burrowing owl or the belding ground squirrel that live in our ecosystem. They're smaller. They're not really big animals, but they're so charismatic. They have these huge eyes and they squeak. And I just think that the desert is an amazing place.
You know, most of us probably have heard the term downwinder. And we spoke just a little while ago about emissions from the underground tanks. But also there were atmospheric emissions that I would think would have affected these people. And has there been any increased incidence of carcinoma or any other kind of disease amongst the tribes or other people that live in the area?
That's a huge issue right now. Native American people along the Columbia River eat more fish per capita than any other population, really. And so salmon and other wildlife are some of the major components of their traditional diet. And that's what keeps them healthy. That's what they love to eat. And for them not to be able to do that is really hard. And so there is worry that they're eating such a quantity of fish in their overall yearly diet that they could be suffering the effects of Hanford in a more acute way.
Right.
And so agencies like the it's basically a group that represents all tribes on the river for the salmon. They have brought this to the attention of the federal government saying, we need a cleaner river. We need less chemicals. We need less pollution. We need less Hanford waste going into our river so that our fish are clean for our people. And that's a very big concern. And I think that with my series, Daughters of Hanford, we will be touching on some of the people who have had effects of contamination from Hanford through their lives. And I'm in the process of studying and looking for a Hanford downwinder, which are the people that kind of suffered the effects of the green runs mm-hmm. at Hanford. And what the green runs were is basically when they were producing some of the radioactive material at Hanford, some of it would get into the air as radioactive iodine, mm-hmm. and it would fall down onto the grasslands and the hay fields, and then cows would eat that grass and it would go directly into the milk, and it was very, very radioactive. And as children drank the most milk at that time and still do, but they at that time they were consuming all of this radioactive milk, and that really affected their thyroids, and it really affected their bodies. And they have had lawsuits ongoing for many, many years to look at the effects that has caused them. And a lot of the downwinders are north and kind of east of Hanford, so the Spokane area, the Idaho area. A lot of that green run kind of followed the air currents up north and east. And in fact, my own father was in Idaho with a Geiger counter. They were looking for uranium. and they were mining, trying to find a claim for uranium mines. And he was up there with his father, and they had this Geiger counter, and the guy that lent it to them showed him how to work it, and it was kind of click, click, click. And my dad was up there in Idaho, and they turned on, they flipped on that Geiger counter, and it just went like that.
Yeah.
And he said he'll never forget that sound, and that they thought, what in the heck is happening? Because we're so far from, you know, anything that would sound like that on a Geiger counter. But he suspects that he had been, subject to a green run that he wasn't aware of at the time.
Yeah, I had a friend when I was younger that grew up in that area, and he died quite young, and I was in a position to watch him die.
I'm so sorry.
And it didn't. It was very unappealing, I might say. But getting back to the, we've got about 4 minutes left, Anna. We're speaking with Anna King. One of the things that we worry about here at the bottom end of the Columbia River is how much of this stuff is getting down to us. And if we're eating fish out of the river here, particularly, for example, sturgeon, which are bottom feeders, what kind of exposure do we have as Astorians?
That's a really good question. Now, on the sturgeon question, I'd feel more comfortable researching that for you and getting back to it. I'd want to talk to some top fish experts that I know about and ask them specifically about sturgeon. One of the agencies that studies that very closely is the CRTFIC. It's an agency that I mentioned before that represents all Native American tribes and fishing on the river. And they have incredible scientists that work on that. And so I would try and ask them about that question, about what's getting into the river now. At the time that they were making plutonium, they were sending a lot of contamination down the river, but a lot of that has washed out to the ocean by now. What's happening now is this slow crawl of groundwater that is working its way towards the river with, all these constituents. There's hexavalent chromium, which is the stuff Aaron Brockovich studied. Mm-hmm. There's other chemicals, and then there's these radionuclides. And like I mentioned, my husband is part of a group that's actually studying how to stop those radionuclides from running with the groundwater and with using microbes. And so it's really interesting science, and there are so many top minds working on this every day trying to make it work. They have huge groundwater treatment plants that are like these big vacuums that vacuum up water out of these massive pumps, run it through these beads and collect all the radioactive and chemical constituents, and then it pumps the water back into the ground. And they have massive facilities the size of like Seattle City water projects, but are pumping and treating this water, and they've built several new ones in just the last couple of years. They're really working very, very hard to keep the river clean. But what we have to remember as voters and as people of the Northwest is we can't bury our heads in the sand. We have to look at the problem. We have to do our best to clean it up.
Anna's husband is here in the studio with us and is a scientist working on this problem. We've got about 1 minute left, and I'd like you to take that minute and just do a little promo for the Daughters of Hanford series of shows that you've produced.
Yeah, I just can't say enough. You know, my favorite stories are stories with heartbeats, and I just want to tell good people stories. And these stories are going to show what women scientists are doing with women who are World War II era Hanford secretaries, women that are cleaning up some of the most horrible radioactive waste that we have right now and are the leaders of Washington State's Ecology Hanford program. These are amazing women's stories. And if you think about it, we all have amazing women in our lives, and Mother's Day's coming right up. Don't forget your card. But I just hope that you'll visit us at daughtersofhanford.org and check out the project. It's going to be debuting this summer in a museum called the Hanford Reach Interpretive Center. And so please come visit us in Richland, look at the project, and follow the stories. There's going to be 12, and our third one just aired this morning.
Anna King and Andy, appreciate you both being with us here today at Coast Community Radio. It's been fascinating talking with you. I could keep going on for the rest of the day if you want, but Unfortunately, or fortunately, coming up very shortly after the news will be Albert Smith and his always wonderful Friday folk show. I urge our listeners to stick around for that. And I believe that next week on Friday, Terry, we're going to be visiting with Astoria Police Chief Brad Johnson. And we're going to be talking about police chief kind of stuff. But Anna, it's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Coast Community Radio and to you, Jim, to having me down here. I just love your city. And we're going to crawl up that tower later on this morning.
The 164th
step. Yeah, I need my steps in today.
All right. Thanks, folks. And we'll talk to you next week.